Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Sarah Howard Parker, and I'm the Director of Operations for the Boston Book Festival. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to thank Massachusetts Center of the Book for sponsoring this session. Hopefully you all got to pick up one of those brand new Route 1 Reads bookmarks on your way in this morning. And speaking of which, if you've been inspired to put together your own literary road trip down Route 1, have I got the opportunity for you. We are looking for new fun ways to support the BBF, and you too could be the owner of a brand new Vespa driving down Route 1 if you choose to purchase a raffle ticket to support us today. So raffle tickets are starting at just $10. They're available at the merchandise booth, which is located right across from Trinity Church, and I hope you'll consider supporting us today. And somebody here is gonna win this Vespa, and it could be you. So thanks so much. We're hugely grateful for the support of corporate and organizational sponsors. And now I'd like to introduce Barry Keller from Mass Center for the Book to say a few words. Thank you.
Hi. As she said, I'm Barry Keller. I'm the program director for the Massachusetts Center for the Book. And it's a Commonwealth affiliate of the Center for the Book in the Library of Congress. So every state in the Union has a Center for the Book. Who knew? We're a public-private partnership charged with developing, supporting, and promoting cultural programming that advances the cause of books and reading, as well as enhancing the outreach potential of Massachusetts libraries. We provide a number of programs throughout the year, and one of them we're very excited to announce, the Massachusetts Book Awards. It recognizes significant works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, children's and young adult literature published by either Commonwealth residents or about Massachusetts subjects. The 2016 winners have just been announced, so stop by our booth to find out who has won the top honors. We do family literacy programs, educational initiatives, and many more exciting events. We're thrilled to be a co-sponsor for today's program. Our Route 1 Reads initiative features mystery writers by authors up and down Route 1 from Maine to Florida. Hank Philippi Ryan, here today, is the chosen author for Massachusetts. So listen carefully about her new book. We're thrilled to, so grab a bookmark and with a list of all the books and read along with us because reading is always an adventure. As I said, we're delighted to be a part of the Boston Book Festival. Today's panel features a panel of master crime fiction authors, Joseph Finder, Chris Holm, and of course, Hank Philippi Ryan. And moderated, I'll now pass the mic over to our moderator and accomplished author in her own right, Amy McKinnon. Thank you.
First of all, welcome everyone to Boston Book Festival 2016. Thank you so much for sharing your precious time with us today in celebration of books and reading and writing. My name is Amy McKinnon, and I will be your moderator. We have a pretty astonishing crew here today. I'd like to introduce them. Joe Finder, here, is the New York Times best-selling author of 13 novels, including Guilty Minds, the thriller award-nominated Suspicion, Buried Secrets, co-winner of the Strand Magazine Critics Award, let me take a breath because this is just amazing, and Killer Instinct, winner of the International Thriller Writers Thriller Award for Best Novel. His latest novel is Guilty Minds. I read it. It's fantastic. Joe Finder.
Thank you.
I'm sure everyone here is familiar with Hank Philippi Ryan. Hank is the on-air investigative reporter for Boston's NBC affiliate, winning 33 Emmys and dozens more journalism honors. The best-selling author of 9 mysteries. Where does she find the time? Ryan's also an award winner, winning author of 5. She's won 5 Agathas, 2 Anthonys, 2 McCavities, the Daphne, and the Mary Higgins Clark Award. What you see is an Agatha and Anthony nominee, and she has received rave starred reviews for her latest novel, which she has here today, So Say No More. It's not published until next month, so you will have an opportunity to buy it before anybody else. Right. Hank Philippi Ryan. Chris Holm is the author of the Collector Trilogy, which blends crime and fantasy, and the Michael Hendricks thrillers. His first Hendricks novel, The Killing Kind, was named a New York Times Editor's Choice, and he won the Anthony Award for Best Novel. That's pretty amazing. His second Hendricks novel, Red Right Hand, is now available. Chris Holm. Before we get started, I just want to say, by the end of this panel, you'll all want to buy their books, and you can do so at the back of the room. So let's get started. This is a question that every writer is asked, but with these three, it's of particular interest because they're all accomplished in their previous fields. Hank as an award-winning journalist, Joe is a master of Russian studies, having attended Harvard and Yale, is it? Yeah, and Chris was studying for his PhD in microbiology. So why, how did they turn to fiction?
No.
Chris, why don't we start with you?
How did I find fiction?
How did you turn to writing fiction?
Yeah, so I was born into a cop family. Mm-hmm. My mom's side of the family are all police officers in Syracuse, New York. My grandfather rose from the beat to deputy chief, and he was a consummate storyteller. He was also a huge fan of mysteries. Every Sunday dinner, he'd have this stack of tattered paperbacks that he'd plowed through in the week before that he'd scatter around the family, and they would all eventually find their way to me. I was one of the first people in my family to go to college, and so my parents wanted me to do something practical. Right. Clearly, I failed miserably in that regard. So I was on a pre-med track. I happened to be good in science, and that's what I wanted to do. And along the way, I fell in love with microbiology, infectious disease research. I thought that I'd become one of those bug hunters that the CDC employs that get dropped into like the Bumba zone of Zaire when there's an outbreak of Ebola. As you can imagine, my wife was thrilled. But when I got into my PhD program, I realized that like the people who were studying to do this, this was all they wanted to do. It was the only thing they wanted to do, and they had to dedicate 70, 80, 90 hours a week to doing that. It wasn't the only thing I wanted to do. It was one of many things I was interested in. And so I found myself miserable in grad school. And my wife, crazy that she is, said, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe you should think about the other things you'd like to do. What else would you like to do with your life? And I said, I think I'd like to try my hand at writing a novel. I had never written for publication before. I had no idea what I was doing. And the first attempt was miserable and terrible and will never ever see the light of day. But along the way, I started writing short stories. I started improving, and now I'm here.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Joe, what's your story?
Did you want to be a writer since you were a kid?
I wanted to be a detective since I was a
kid. I don't know. I wanted to be a writer since I was 8.
Really?
Yeah.
Tess Gerritsen talks
and
about
a lot
this.
Of writer friends of mine.
Yeah, she says you self-select at that
yeah.
age. That's so
yeah.
interesting to hear.
And it's almost like what's going to stop me from becoming a writer?
Hmm.
You know? So I knew I didn't want to teach. I didn't want to go into the intelligence field. I was interested in Russia, which was my expertise. Mm-hmm. And I did think pretty seriously about joining the CIA. My problem is that my idea of what a CIA officer did was shaped by Robert Ludlum. So I had this idea that all CIA officers were issued Glocks and had, you know, secret bank accounts and that sort of thing. And it turned out it's not true. Rats. So anyway, I just started, I was reading all these thrillers, I loved them, and I said to my now wife at the time, my girlfriend, I said, man, I'm so much better than this. I can do this. Oh, yeah. And she said, well, are you going to do it already? You're talking about doing it for the last couple years. Do it, yes or no. She used a colorful expression I will not use here.
We are in a church.
All right, yeah. Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. right. Thank you, Chris. But anyway, I decided to, I gave myself 3 years to see if I could sell a book. And I wrote the book and rewrote it and rewrote it, and the first draft was horrible, of course, like it is. There's a Russian proverb, the first pancake is always a lump, you know? I, within 3 years, was able to get an agent and sell the book, and at that point I decided I can do this.
What book was that?
That was Moscow Club, my first novel.
So thanks. When was that?
That was in 1991.
And you've been writing ever since?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Writing fiction ever since. I mean, the truth is, I actually wrote a nonfiction book when I was 22.
Yeah.
And so I had written a nonfiction book, but I knew I didn't want to do this.
And that was an analysis of...
That was
Russia.
A book called Red Carpet about Dr. Armand Hammer, another big American businessman who had connections to the Soviet Union.
And that's informed your writing.
Yeah, it did. I mean, Moscow Club was sort of taken from that
research,
really.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, but I didn't want to be a nonfiction writer. I just wanted to be a novelist.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant, and it's worked out so well. So. And Hank, how about you? You've gone from being Boston's darling and the most feared investigative reporter to an award-winning novelist.
I know, you don't want to get a phone call from
no,
me.
No, Hank calls, hang up.
Channel 7. It's so funny because when I do book talks and people say, I've never seen you smile, you know, you're always asking the tough questions. It's a wonderful, I grew up in really rural Indiana, mm-hmm. so rural that you couldn't see another house from our house. And my sisters and I used to ride our ponies to the library to get books, and we would fill up the saddlebags with books and then read up in the hayloft of the barn behind our house. And that's where I fell in love with Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot and Nancy Drew. And I really fell in love with storytelling, with the idea that a clever, smart author could lure you in and weave a story and keep you turning the pages, and in the end could surprise you, a person could write a novel that you love, that you thought about, that stayed with you. And I wanted to be a mystery author or a detective, you know, and write Nancy Drew or be Nancy Drew. Either one was fine. So my career took a different direction. And I've been a television reporter for 30 some years, when one day at Channel 7, I had an idea for a story, for a mystery novel. And you know how when you get a good idea, and there's just sort of this goosebumps of, yeah, that's gonna work. And I went home and I said to my husband, I've got the idea for the mystery novel that I've been wanting to write for the past 50 years. I'm going to write a mystery. And my husband says, great, sweetheart. Do you know how to write a mystery? And I said, how hard can it be? You know, I've read a million of them. But from that moment, and that was 2005-ish, I think, four maybe, I was obsessed with it. You ask how I find the time. I was obsessed. There was nothing that could have taken me away from that solitude in front of my computer, making up a story that would surprise people and lure people in and make them want to turn the pages. So I just walked through a door that I had always wanted to open and found my calling at age 55. You know, that it's crazy.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. It you made your dreams come true.
I did.
Yeah, that's...
Knock on wood, so far, so good.
Yeah, pretty. You're doing pretty well. So I have had the pleasure of reading each of their latest books, which I highly recommend. And there's a common theme throughout each of them that they appear to be inspired by real-life events. Can you talk a little bit about how that works for you? Joe, if you want to start.
Yeah. Each of my books is a what-if inspired by either a story someone told me or something I read. And in the case of the new book, Guilty Minds, this was inspired by a sex scandal involving the governor of New York, Eliot Spitzer. And when he was forced to resign because he'd hired call girls, etc. I saw the story, and I saw that the FBI had announced they had busted this call girl ring, and one of the clients, client number 9, was the governor of New York State, Eliot Spitzer. And I remember thinking, what is the FBI doing investigating a call girl ring? They don't do that. That's not the kind of thing the FBI does. So the more I began to sort of read around the story, the more I realized this was a kind of conspiracy. There's a documentary that came out called Client 9. By the way, what happened to clients 1 through 8?
Exactly, that's what I was thinking. That. Who's number one?
Right, anyway. The documentary makes the point that Eliot Spitzer had some really powerful enemies that he'd made as Attorney General. And he and a couple of them brought him down by hiring a private investigator to follow him around and get the dirt on him. And guess what? He had dirt. So it occurred to me at that point, what would happen if someone wanted to remove someone from someone powerful? Mm-hmm. What would happen if the story was completely made up? How would you get away with this? Yeah. And so I came up with this idea of using a gossip website, sort of like Gawker or TMZ, to disseminate a story which was wholly false, and my hero's job is to disprove it.
Yeah, and so many twists and turns along the way. It constantly surprised me. Hank, how about you? When I read your book, I immediately thought of a recent Globe Spotlight series on schools and administrators allegedly covering up sexual assaults on their campuses. And I'm wondering how that informed your latest book, Say No More.
Well, think about, Say No More is about the power of silence. It's about sexual assaults on college campuses and a young woman who is afraid to talk about it. But the main character is a reporter who's trying to do a documentary on sexual assaults on college campuses and runs into a cover-up scheme. More I cannot say. But when you think about the sort of rip from the headlines element of Say No More, a couple quick things about that. One, I started writing this book almost 2 years ago, so the headlines were very different 2 years ago. And one of the things that happens sometimes in books is that some idea gets planted or some zeitgeisty thing is out there and gives me the idea. Of course, as a reporter, I've done stories about campus sexual assault, and it just seemed like this was a topic that needed to be explored because it's something we don't want to talk about, it's something we don't want to hear, and I thought, being a crime fiction author is a way to sneak in in the midst of entertainment, some education, some enlightenment, some consciousness of learning about something. And the point of campus sexual assault is that it's hidden and it's in the shadows and we don't want to talk about it. That's what I wanted to explore. It's a story of one young woman, and that's just one third of the book, and we'll talk a little bit about the rest of it later. But I wanted to bring that. I wanted to bring that out. I wanted to have us talk about it. And the thing that I learned quickly that's so interesting, that it's, I realized how much, and I don't mean to use the word easy, how much easier it is to write about murder and violence. Murder than it is to write about rape. I mean, I sat at my computer, fingers poised to write this campus sexual assault book, and I thought, how am I going to do this? Yeah. You know, how am I going to say to you, this is an exciting page-turning thriller about campus sexual assault, and you should all buy it. You know, how can that not be exploitive? So I needed to be really careful with this very timely topic and turn that into a thriller that you could read with something that was a nugget of reality and knowledge that you needed.
Right, and especially in this time, you helped to validate the victim's perspective and experience. And
well,
that's really important.
Yes. When you think about 1 in 5, 20% of young women who go to college will be sexually assaulted, and 90% of those assaults happen in the first week on campus. They call that the red zone. And yet, many colleges don't report that there are any campus sexual assaults at all. That just cannot be. Dozens and dozens, I think 150 colleges are under investigation now by the feds for withholding information about these incidents. And again, this is a third of the book, but I'm so proud of that element of it because you will understand all sides of the problem
and how it all ties into the bigger story.
Exactly.
Now, Chris,
Was it LitHub where you just had that piece published?
Yes, on the negative consequences of viral fame, yes.
Yes, I mean, that was fascinating and so timely. Can you talk a little bit about how that ties into your book?
Sure. So I tend to think that one of the great things about being a writer is we get to chase our obsessions. And I tend to find that, for me, a book usually happens at the intersection of two disparate ideas, two disparate things that I'm obsessed with. And one of the things that I was fascinated by and somewhat horrified by is the fact that now, as a consequence of modern life, we watch mass tragedies unfold in real time on social media.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a terror attack or a mass shooting, you get the news report, that top-level report, who's responsible, what the federal response is, chasing after the bad guys. But then you get these stories from the ground, these acts of heroism and venality at the scene. And that fascinates me because those are very human stories, and they're often obscured by the big picture story. So that was one thing I wanted to explore with Red Right Hand, which opens with a terror attack on U.S. soil. But one of the other things that I'm endlessly fascinated by is viral fame. And in fact, I literally just had a piece come out yesterday about this, where I talk about the woman who we all know as the Chewbacca lady, right? She posts a video of herself on Facebook in a Chewbacca mask, and come noon the next day, she's got 140 million views. She ends up on The Tonight Show. Her kids get scholarships to college. She meets Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca, you know. But then you look at some other people. The next big viral craze that came along after her was a 14-year-old kid who took a video of his buddy and complimented his sartorial choices, right down to his white Vans that he was back at it again with. And that kid had a good run, too. He ended up in a Weezer video. He ended up with a lifetime supply of those white Vans. But he also had his Twitter account hacked by white supremacists who started flooding his feed with racist propaganda. And then he was spotted. He was a 14-year-old boy. And then he was swatted. And I don't know if you know what that is, but that's a particularly insidious prank where somebody calls in a false police call that results in a home being raided by a SWAT team. So his family was watching TV one night, and a SWAT team burst in through their doors and pinned him to the floor before they found out it was a false alarm. I find that fascinating.
And that's the opening of your latest novel, Red Right Hand, is...
Yeah, it is this notion that, like, you know, sometimes going viral is not a good thing. Right. And so in the opening of the book, there's a family taking video of the Golden Gate Bridge, and they happen to catch a terror attack. But in that video, which becomes the definitive image of that terror attack, a former federal witness who's thought dead is in the foreground for a brief moment. And suddenly his face is on every TV in the country.
That's such a good idea.
I know. It was so good. It was so good. Okay, so what you're all getting here is that you should read newspapers to get some ideas for your work. And watch the news, of course. But what these three did in their novels, I read a lot. I am a former journalist. I am very good at research. But when I read their books, I realized I ain't got nothing on them. So can you talk a little bit about the research that you did for your books? Because I learned so much just from reading them, as well as being entertained. Hank, why didn't you start?
People ask about research. When I think about research, and when you ask, have I been doing research for my books? And I want to say, sweetheart, I've been doing research for 40 years. You know, I just didn't know it, because every day as a reporter, there's something that happens that the life of a reporter is to have an idea and then delve into it as deeply as you mm-hmm. possibly can, and then take a lot of complicated information and make it compelling and entertaining and make it into a good story that will change the world and get some justice and make a difference.
And also translate it for the masses.
Exactly.
Because it can be very complicated material.
And that's the fun part to me. The research is a treasure hunt to me. Isn't it for you to come up with the beautiful little gorgeous
yes.
nuggets
truffles.
That are going to exactly...
Yeah,
we're just like little truffles.
That.
that are going to make the story be gorgeous and unique and compelling. But the research is interesting because what I'm trying to do is make a new world that feels like the real world, but that's populated by, I mean, my people are fiction. There's nobody in it that's real. And what they do has to feel real and natural and motivated. The opening, we're talking about the opening scene. The opening scene of Say No More is a reporter who witnesses a hit and run accident, which is exactly what happened to me. I mean, yes.
So
my husband and I,
were
driving on Monsignor O'Brien Highway, and I heard this noise, and I turned, and the person in the car next to me, a guy, had smashed into the van in front of him. And I turned and looked at him so carefully, and I sort of my reporter brain kicked in, and I thought, widow's peak, pointy eyebrows, pointy nose, high cheekbones,
thin chin.
And then he backed up and zoomed away. And I thought, oh my gosh, hit and run. And so the guy in the van got out and the police came and I said to the police, you know, I saw him and I got the license number, you know, which I wrote in the I wrote in the dust on the dashboard of our car. So later I got a call from the assistant DA saying, can you come to court and identify this person? We're going to have a non-suggestive identification hearing where there's going to be an audience like this, and I want you to see if you recognize him in the courtroom. So this is a dilemma. This is a dilemma. What do I do? And I started thinking, as a reporter, it's a dilemma because I don't want to be part of the story. But as a human being, I thought, what if I identify this person and it puts me in danger? What if this is a scary thing I'm about to do? And then I thought, oh, that's a book, you know. That's a book. And that's the opening scene, and that's really the big picture story of Say No More, is the main character deciding what she should say about this hit and run accident that she saw and identifying the person.
But also, sexual assault figures in.
Yes. Yeah. So there's two storylines, as there always are in my book. So there's the sexual assault storyline and the alibi witness, the hit and run accident.
In Willow. Can we just pause a moment and think, what bad luck for that guy to have the investigative reporter who notices every detail be a witness.
Well, and let this be a lesson, never clean your dashboard.
Now, Joe, in your acknowledgments, you thank quite a few people who, I guess, helped you with all of the technology and all of the investigative work. It was amazing what you did in that story. I learned so much. Now I know how to trace a cell phone number. So can you talk a little bit about how you, first of all, had the opportunity to speak with these people and how you wove it in so seemingly effortlessly into the story?
Well, I'm sort of like Hank in the sense that I love the research part of writing. I love it too much. It is a drug, and I have to sort of contain myself, and I have to tell myself, Joe, you know enough now. You can do it, right? But I need to sort of figure out the world that I'm writing about, and I need enough detail to make it feel real to the reader. Mm-hmm. But I also want to know for myself how things work. Like, how do you trace a cell phone call? And since there's a murder at the center of this book, how does a homicide detective solve a very complex staged suicide? And by now, I've got a Rolodex of sources, and they are tolerant of me. What's that?
Would you share them with me?
They're in the acknowledgments.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know them.
And I will, by now my sources are tolerant, so I'll call up and I'll say, all right, so let's say, right? And they will play along. And I had, for example, the one thing I find most boring to write about is hacking. I think it's really so tedious. But hacking can be scary and cool. So I spent a lot of time on the phone with a hacker who told me how this would be done, and I put in very few scenes, just little mentions here and there. And you know, there's an old cliche in our business that research is like an iceberg. You should only see the top 10%. That's it. The rest is submerged. So the whole point is to make it feel as unresearched as possible.
Yeah.
I used to read a lot of Tom Clancy, but I was not a fan because I sort of felt, look, I didn't want to learn how to operate the submarine. I wanted to ride in the submarine, you know?
Yeah.
So that's always been a lesson to me. Just don't show off.
Well, you certainly took us for a ride. So, Chris, can you talk about how your research informed your book? Because I was saying to Chris at the beginning of this, oh, my God, that ending. I was expecting this, maybe. This, yeah, wow, that's pretty good. But then at the very end, you can you just talk a little bit about how you wove in all of the shadow?
I just make stuff up. I don't know. No, in all seriousness, and to your point, I just wanted to say my agent has a saying when he calls me out on something that's too nonspecific, too generic, where he says, look, Chris, you got to know their shoe size. But then I put the shoe size in there one time. I really gave him that draft that gave him everything. And he said, but you don't need to tell us their shoe size.
Exactly.
You
know,
I think you're right. You need to,
have authority.
You need to have authority.
Yeah.
And your example of hacking is perfect because that's something that you need to know what they're doing. You don't need to tell the audience necessarily what they're doing, but you need to know the steps they're going to go through.
One of my author friends says, you want to make sure your research slip isn't showing.
Oh,
ooh,
I like that.
That's good.
Wear slips.
Yeah. In my case...
That's another panel.
Right.
I tend to research as I go. Because I don't like falling into that research well where I spend 6 months researching things that are never going to make it into the book. So I'm a very slow writer because I research as I write. And I'm also not an outliner. So when you talk about the Red Right Hand in particular is a bit of a conspiracy thriller. And there are a lot of elements that are seemingly disparate that hopefully by the end come together into a satisfying conclusion. And I will cop to the fact that I had no idea what I was doing until about halfway through the book.
Huh.
Yeah, I had that opening scene in mind of a family taking that video, capturing someone on film who should not have been captured. I have a series character. He's a hitman who only hits other hitmen. And I knew that he would protect this witness because he wanted some of the information that this man had. And I knew the very last line of the novel, and that was it. And, you know, in my arrogant writerly way, I thought, and some conspiracy stuff that will happen probably. And I got about halfway through the book before I really saw how the threads all interconnected, at which point I had a freak out, stopped writing, and went back to the beginning, thinking, I need to make sure I bake this in, or it's not going to feel earned. But a funny thing happened when I was reading that first half of the book, and it was that I realized I had dropped in little nuggets and little details that didn't necessarily make sense to me at the time, but served that story. A good friend of mine, the writer Michael Corita, who's a terrific thriller writer, likes to say that for his first draft, he feels like his job is just to get out of the way.
Yeah.
He puts his fingers on the keyboard and he tries to write and see where it takes him. And then he's always surprised by how well some things come together. And the short version of writing Red Right Hand is that's what happened. The longer version is that's what happened after about 8 months of panic attacks and freaking out.
Oh, good. So you still have.
Do you talk to your agent, right? Your editor? What are you doing?
I actually, my wife is a bit of a ringer because she's a reviewer for PW and Mystery Scene. So she's probably better read in the genre than just about anybody. And what I do when I'm stuck is we take walks. Mm-hmm. We take long walks and we work out plot points.
Great.
Or I'll go for a run where I can't write anything down if I wanted to. You know, I find 2 miles into a 4 mile run, that's where I start to solve some plot problems.
I mean, it's interesting because I have no idea what will happen in the end of the books either.
You don't.
I have no idea what will happen in the next
paragraph.
So you're
a discovery writer.
Like being a reporter is being a discoverer along the way. I can't know the end of a television story until I get there. So I don't know the end of my thrillers until I get there. But of course, there's that moment. I mean, I was 80,000 words into Say No More, and I came out to my husband and said, I can't write this, I can't solve the crime, I don't know, because I'm setting up the crime as I go, and I'm solving it along with my main characters. And I said, I have no idea what happens here. And he says, well, honey, you certainly know who the bad guy is. And I said, no, I don't. And but when I figured out the end, I was by myself in my study, and I stood up and applauded. I'm like, I got this. So, talk about a surprise ending. It was a surprise to me, and it always is. And don't you hope for that?
Don't you think your subconscious knows?
Yes.
You must. If you're planning these things, on some level, you're figuring it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You think so?
Do you think so?
Does it happen to you?
I do.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I have this trick where if I have a difficult problem to solve, I'll take notes on it before I go to sleep, and when I wake up, I've figured it out almost always.
Ooh.
My brain is just like a slow cooker, you know?
Yeah.
That's a great tip.
Well, and sometimes I feel like it's a bit like trying to remember where you left your keys. The more, or that, you know, you're trying to think of the name of the song that's in your head, the more you chase that, the more it retreats.
Yeah.
If you can find a way to focus on something else for just a little while, your mind keeps cooking.
Yeah.
It does.
True.
Sometimes I think, you know, I'll just get up and have a cup of tea because I can't think of this. And the minute my body just starts to stand up, I think, oh, no, wait, that's it. Because exactly as you say, Chris, I've just let go of it. Sometimes that works.
So this panel discussion, the theme is crime fiction. How do we find comfort in that? Because the topics are usually dark. So if we could just quickly, because we want to get some questions from the audience, if we could just quickly answer. So Chris, starting with you, does it give you some sense of power to decide the outcomes of something horrible? Do you feel?
No, I actually, with Red Right Hand, I felt a lot of responsibility. I wrote, and this is true, I wrote such a bloodless draft, I think my second or third draft that I showed my editor it's a novel that involves a terror attack and, you know, a violent man, you know, protecting a former mobster from some very bad dudes. Nobody died. I mean, there was off-screen death, but there wasn't a lot of violence on the page because what I was writing was so dark. I feel like I held back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I got much catharsis from deciding who lives and who dies. I wanted them all to make through okay.
Mm-hmm.
My editor Josh said, "Look, I'm going to write three names down on a piece of paper, and at least one of them has to die." for me, the satisfaction, I think, is when we have that fog of war in these mass tragedies, we don't often get that satisfying conclusion.
Right.
I don't think you need to have a happy ending necessarily, but we all ask why.
Right.
Why did this happen? What was the reason? And for me, I think the catharsis was partially in the redemptive arc for my main character, who hopefully is getting to be a better person over the course of the series, but it was also in getting to answer in a fundamental way, why did this happen?
And Joe, if you can speak to that, do you feel some sort of contentment making sense of chaos?
Yeah, I think thrillers are all about the restoration of order.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And thrillers are actually very important. And I don't just say that because I write them. But a friend of ours, Lee Child, makes the very good point that when storytelling was invented thousands of years ago, 3,000-4,000 years ago, it was done in order to create a sense of community, to create empathy. We learn how to empathize from fiction. And danger, sort of a safe way to explore danger. And we get this vicarious satisfaction.
Right.
We learn and we get to do things that we would never do in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the safe danger is, I think, the aspect of writing thrillers that I find.
That's an excellent point. And Hank, in your line of work, investigative reporting, then your other job, you see a lot of injustice in the world. Do you have some sense of satisfaction providing justice in your novels?
Well, I think it's fascinatingly and heartwarmingly similar. Investigative reporting and crime fiction writing, because you have characters who you care about, a problem that needs to be solved, you want the good guys to win and the bad guys to get what's coming to them, and in the end you want some justice and you want to change the world. And that, whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction, that's exactly the same thing. It's just in fiction I get to make stuff up And that is, and we have fun. I mean, that's a joy to create a thing that didn't exist before. You know, look, I made a hat where there never was a hat. That's what I do every day. And then I get to, then the book gets to be completed when the reader reads it and enters that world that came only from my imagination. I mean, it just brings tears to your eyes to think about that.
That's beautiful. It really is. So we would like to take some questions from the audience. We have a microphone here if people would like to step up, or if you have a nice, strong voice and would like to shout from your seat. Do we have any questions? Yes.
So I'm an editor, so I'm one of those people that don't understand how any of you write a book.
Oh, ooh. Good question.
Because there must be a lot of revising and mystery writing that just much more than in other genres, I guess.
I will say writing is revising, right?
Well, I love revising. Mm-hmm. You have this secure feeling, you've got the pile of pages there, mm-hmm. that yeah. the very worst, you finish the book, kind of. And then revision is just making it sharper, making it better, making the word choice more interesting. I much prefer revising, actually, because the writing has got that built-in anxiety of will I get this figured out?
Yeah.
Will I do it?
What about you?
Oh, I agree. I'm a big fan of revision. I actually go through usually 6 or 7 drafts before my books are done. And I always think that it's much easier to make a good book out of a bad book than it is to make a bad book out of nothing.
Right.
Exactly.
And I find that that's where I realize what the book's about and what I was trying to do, and I can make it, you know, the best version of itself.
Yeah.
When I'm writing my first draft, I'm sitting at my computer saying, just go on, just go on, just keep going, just keep going, just keep going. Because my goal is to get to the moment when I can revise and make it good. That first book I told you about that I wrote turned out to be 723 pages long.
I remember that.
And I had to cut 400 pages.
Wow.
I hope you saved those pages.
They were all terrible.
Don't waste anything.
But, you know, so you go through and you take out what's repetitive, what's derivative, what's a copy, mm-hmm. what's not interesting, what doesn't matter, what's a tangent, the stuff that shouldn't have been in there. When you're trying to be good, you know, that all goes. When you're trying to be funny, that all goes. And right? And then when you take out all those parts that shouldn't be there, and you put together the essence of it, and you think, oh, that's the book I meant to write, my book. Yeah. And that's, you know, that moment, briefly, is fabulous.
Briefly.
And that's music to an editor's ears, right? Yes.
I was very interested in your, I'm rather short. I was very interested in your discussion about not letting the research get in the way. My problem, well, if it's a problem, my published work is all history. And I wanted to write a thriller crime novel because I love it. And I couldn't lie. I felt like I was lying because my training is in history. Mm-hmm. And yet I have what I think is a good idea for a book. But I tried for 2 years. I could not let my research brain get out of the way enough to storytell.
Go see Hamilton.
In a different way.
Yeah. Go see Hamilton.
So if you have any tips, I'll write them down.
Joe has a great one.
I'm just mentioning, just go see Hamilton if you can get a ticket in the next 5 years.
Yeah. My suggestion would be make a new history.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it as real that you're creating. And it just has to be as true for your history as real history, which is like, how do we know anyway? So make it be true for you. That's all. That's what matters.
The trouble is that when you get trained as a historian, the what if is absolutely forbidden. Really, it's not. It's
well,
not.
And that,
well,
that's
so it's
that's
hard to fiction. Switch your brain, you know.
But let me get to another question. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's our plan.
Because sometimes they don't get there in time, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, anything can happen.
Yeah, mysteries and thrillers are different,
mm-hmm.
right? Sure. Mysteries are whodunits, and thrillers are howdunits. It really is about the process. And we often know who the bad guy is in a thriller. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any difference to the suspense. The suspense is about the journey in mm-hmm. the case of a thriller.
But don't you think that's why they call it crime fiction now?
Yes.
Because it's a problem that needs to be solved, whether it's the bad guy needs to be stopped, or the bad guy needs to be found, or it's just general suspense. I mean, yeah. You were saying nobody got killed for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I'll say about that is I think there is no such thing as a pure book of any genre. There is no such thing as a pure mystery, or a pure thriller, or a pure romance novel. They all have elements of you know, thrillers, of horror, of romance, of mystery. I think a lot of my thrillers tend to have an element of mystery because I'm a mystery fan and a thriller fan. Mm-hmm. You know, there are purer thrillers than others. I don't think there's usually a ton of mystery in, say, a Reacher novel.
Right.
You tend to know, I mean, he's going to march his way through the bad guys until he gets, you know, the job done. But there are a lot of thrillers that I think have elements of mystery and intrigue.
Most do, I think.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So I would say that if you feel like we're just playing with your heads, you just need to find a thriller writer who is dialed into this sort of style that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. Don't give up on us yet.
And what's your question?
Hi. So you spoke a lot about getting inspiration from, like, your lives and, like, from the headlines. I was wondering if there's any, like, fiction writing you get inspired by, or television shows?
Great question.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think all of us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think all writers are fans first. And what tends to inspire me is the stuff that's sort of outside of what I do to some extent. People who can access things that I can't access. I'm a huge fan of Megan Abbott because she shows me a world. A lot of her books take place in sort of a milieu of adolescent girls. That's something that I have no access to as an adult male, and so that sort of broadens what I'm able to write because she gives
you sort of learn from it. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Pick things out, and I think, you know, we're all fans first.
And I'm a fan of various movies and TV shows. Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad got me very excited creatively. I sort of began to think it led me to write my book Suspicion. Wow. So I take inspiration from good novels, mm-hmm. good crime fiction, as well as television.
I mean, watching The Wire and watching The Night Of, and watching those wonderful shows that are, you know, not only cinematic but literate is just so inspirational. I remember listening to Serial, the podcast, and thinking, oh, this is great. I wonder how I can write a book like that. And then I thought, I do. That's exactly, it's a murder mystery.
Right.
But it's the thing that they don't tell you is that reading, after you've written several books, that reading other books becomes a very different exercise. Mm-hmm. Because I'm always trying to dissect them and see what architecture is and see what their tricks the author is doing, and or sometimes thinking, I could never be this good, or sometimes thinking, wow, this is really terrible. But it takes away when you find a book that you purely read and you forget to edit it in your head, that's the joy.
Yeah.
That's the moment. We became writers because we loved reading. Mm-hmm. But now our reading experience is completely different.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Right? And I sort of feel like I'll read a book and I'm sort of like a plastic surgeon at a cocktail party. Exactly. Looking at a woman saying, I could fix that chair.
So next question.
Amy and I are going like this.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for your super presentation. I've learned a lot, and it's fun. My question is, I'm writing a novel, it's finished, set in Ireland, but it's for the American market. So there's possibly some things that don't translate well in terms of sense of humor or style. Dialogue too, but I can deal with that. Is there any advice that you might...
You're writing, it's set in Ireland?
Set in Ireland, yes.
And it's for an American audience?
For the American market, yep.
Right. Well, that's a good, I mean, I have writer friends in the UK who can barely get published here because they're writing about a world that is so alien to us.
Mm-hmm.
So you
that's
need
the
to
problem,
sort of
yeah.
make sure that you explain it in a way that you probably wouldn't for a UK audience, for an Irish audience.
Yeah, and Irish crime in general is its own subgenre in a sense. Yeah. And there are some wonderful, wonderful Irish crime writers. Stuart Neville comes to mind as somebody who I just think is absolutely terrific. And he does sell over here, and he I think sells pretty well. But the trick is simply to do it as well as you can and try not to sweat the market too much. Yeah. Because, you know, if I don't know if you have an agent or if you're about to seek out an agent or anything, make it the best book you can and then see what happens.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say take the personal and make it universal.
Yes.
That's a good way.
Yes.
At heart, we're all the same. I think there was a question
Thank
over here.
Thank you very
here.
Much.
Yes, miss, in the front row.
So can you talk a little bit about how you are able to pack your text so full of life?
Thank you. Could you just come to the microphone and say all that good stuff? Thank you.
The question was, Hank is amazing. Hank is so talented. How does she pack her books with so much life?
But you were asking how I make them fast-paced and real. And that is what we were talking about your question about revision. I go back through, I tell a story. I want, just like sometimes I finish a sentence. Just as when I'm writing a television story, I know that I don't want you to click the remote. I don't want you to turn my story off. So I don't want you to think reading and think, oh, you know, I really have other stuff to do. I don't really need to read this. I want you to need to turn the page, need to find out what happens next. So in that revision process, I say, why is this scene here? Why is this paragraph here? Why is this sentence here? Is this sentence doing the most work it can possibly do? Is every word in here the best, most conflict packed, action packed, necessary, deep word that it can possibly be? And everything that isn't goes. So I need to take you inside characters' heads, and I need to take you into their world, and I need to take them into motivation, and I need to have secrets. Is all of that in there? And then I think my book is called Say No More. Is that embodied in the subtext of every part of this book? So there's undercurrents in all of it that won't be on the surface, but that are leading you through the story, I hope. So if that's what you're getting from it, thank you. That's great. What do you all think?
Well, I couldn't possibly expound upon that. That was pretty perfect.
Sir.
All right, so my question is about setting in general. I've read, you know, novels set right here in Boston, where I've grew up, spent my entire life, and I've read novels set, you know, as far from here as possible. North Korea has been my recent. And I'm curious if, as readers, do you prefer having a setting that's familiar, or do you prefer something totally different, which adds to sort of a mystery or intrigue?
Wow. I think I prefer a setting that is fully beautifully realized, whether it's around the corner from me or around the world. I want something that I can connect to and understand and feel like I have a sense of that place when I read.
Well, where your family was when they took the film video. Have you been there?
No, I've not been to that spot. I've
really?
Never been.
Goodness. Yeah. I never would have guessed.
I agree.
Thank you.
Wow.
But no, actually, I find sometimes as a writer, not to drift from the question too far, but I find it sometimes paralyzing to write a place I know very, very well.
Yeah.
Because as the woman who asked the question about being a history buff and a historian, she feels compelled not to lie.
Yeah.
I get so bogged down in detail when I write Portland, Maine, where I live, but I feel a little freer if I'm exploring someplace else. I would never dare write a place like San Francisco from a local's perspective.
Right.
So I'm writing it from the perspective of someone who is not local to that area.
Oh, yeah. That's smart.
I have never stood in that exact spot.
Wow.
I've made up towns and cities for settings. simply because I didn't want to be hamstrung by, is that a one-way street?
Right. Because you will be called out on it.
I will get email, mm-hmm. for sure. So, but I think I agree with what Chris is saying, that really you want the setting to feel real and rich and fully realized. And if you live in Boston and you can do Boston that way, mm-hmm. That's no guarantee that you can.
That's
plenty
true.
Of times we don't see the things that make it interesting. If I fly to a city I don't know, I'm my eyes are open. I'm taking, I have details in there that I would not have gotten in Boston.
It's funny because it works the other way too. My books are very much set in Boston, 99% of which is true. But for instance, there was a scene where I had to have a car turn another way, stop at an intersection where I know there's no light. So I had to have somebody complain, I hate that new light, you know, for the people. And then...
That's clever.
And then, but it's so real to me that my husband and I will be driving up the Mass Pike and I'll say, oh, exit 17, this is where Jane was chased by the bad guy. Right. And then I think, no, I made that up. You know, that didn't happen here. So the setting works both ways.
All right, so last question, and then we have to wrap things up. You've had your hand up.
So I had a series prior to the Michael Hendricks series that recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned crime pulp. And so if you picture, you know, angels driving Crown Vicks and demons running speakeasies, that's the theme of it. But no, the Hendricks books are straight-up thrillers. Yeah.
So I want to thank each and every one of you for taking time out of your day to share it with us. We so appreciate it. And for all of you, I highly recommend, again, buy their books. They're amazing. You can buy them at the right there in the lobby. And again, with Hank's book, it isn't even published yet. She arranged to have it here for you.
Only today. Here, and then it goes away for 3 weeks.
But get all three of them. Winter is coming. So. Thank you all so much.